We welcome Sharon Weaver as our speaker today. Sharon earned a master's degree of divinity at Vanderbilt University, and she has held work positions as a teacher, nonprofit worker, and college professor. Sharon currently operates a consulting company called Spiritual Care Providers. The title of Sharon's sermon is The Imitation Game. Must we choose? Let's welcome Sharon.
Thank you, Joe. It's good to see everyone, as always. Glad you all are here, despite the cold weather. I love that it's this particular Sunday where we're going to talk about love and those who don't particularly have much of a chance at expressing their love openly and freely in our society, although that's changing. When Alabama allows for gay marriage, you have to give credit that something's changing. No offense to Alabama, because Tennessee's not there yet. I want to start out by talking about a gentleman, Alan Turing, and I'm sure most of you know of him, but I'm going to assume that you don't. He's the reason I could research him without having to go to the UK and actually look up documents about his life in the library. He has been credited with being the father, founder of computer science. He was a mathematician, and he was just this remarkable man. It's hard to describe him. Philosopher, which you wouldn't normally think of. Creator. He was amazing. And I knew of him, but recently went to see a movie called The Imitation Game. Has anyone seen the movie? Yeah, it's good. There's a 1996 movie called Codebreakers, or Making of the Codebreakers. That's Breaking the Code, I guess that's what it is. And it's also about Alan Turing. Has anyone seen that one? Yeah. It's a little more... presents him in a little different light than The Imitation Game. All of them inadequate in the way that it's always inadequate when you try to present someone else's life in a different time and era than when it actually took place. So my apologies for Alan for all the attempts that we have been doing to dissect and understand you and the profound effect that you've had upon our world in ways that you never intended. So I'll continue with that. There's a plaque. It says Alan Matheson Turing, 1912 to 1954. He was 41 when he died. It goes on to say, father of computer science, mathematician, wartime codebreaker, victim of prejudice. And that's how it ends. So that's complicated, enmeshed in a lot of things. So what I've understood about Mr. Turing, Dr. Turing, to be more precise, was that he was a genius and suffered in the 1940s, 50s, I guess more the 40s, growing up, when he was in boys' school. In school, you could just drop off boys, but certainly in school. And he was different. He was different in his social awkwardness, a quotation from his teachers at school, you know, writing about him. Different in his genius, different in his determination and his focus on what he wanted to learn and what he wanted to study. And so he was indeed bullied, what we would call bullied these days, and very much a loner in school. There is a scene in The Imitation Game where he is boarded up into the floor. Some boys that he classmates moved a desk and popped up the nails of the wood floors and put him in the sort of crawl space between the flooring and dirt in the subflooring area, and nailed him back up and moved the desk back over, and he was found. But that must have been profoundly frightening and scary. But that was a scene that was actual in the documentation of his autobiography and in his writings and his life. When I was researching, I kept thinking about how do we know this stuff, sort of secondhand. And then I revisit the fact that, no, wait a minute, it's not been so long ago. You know, he even had the opportunity to visit in the UK the museum of, I think it's computers, I've forgotten the name right now, but the museum that houses one of his later computers, machines, thinking machines. And in 1951, 3 years before his death, he was able to go and visit that and see some of the other scientists slash friends of his and their machines. And it was, the curator said it was amazing, you know, one of the machines that actually moved and was triggered by light. And it was a very new thing for us at that time, and said that Turing figured it out while he was there. You know, looking it over, and I was like, oh, yeah, I see how he did it, you know. So, and so for some of you that have seen The Imitation Game, that have read the information online, that have read books and seen the other movies, you may be very frustrated at, you know, some of the portrayal. I say bravo that we have movies and books about Alan Turing that we're interested in him and his life. It's not so much that he was a very bright man. It's not so much that he was the father of this or that. He actually was, as Churchill said, and I want to get the quote right. Winston Churchill believed that he was the person who made the single biggest contribution to the Allied effort in the victory of World War II. He saved so many lives. At a time when Germany had a machine called the Enigma, it was a coding machine, and so it was unbreakable at the time. And the Allies were losing lives and guns, machinery, mainly ships, all the time, terrible, great losses. And so the British government gathered in code breakers, gathered in the smartest of the smartest to try and figure out and break the code. And Alan Turing was among them. He actually led the group. There were more people there, and he had help, but he led the group in designing, developing a computer. It was based upon a sort of the concept of a computer that was started in Poland. It was called the BOM. And he took it, and it's created based upon some of that concept, took it and created a computer that could break the code. Now, that sounds wonderful and all easy, and, you know, we'll hail him as a genius and hail him as a war hero, but why did it take so long for us to know this? I mean, that's not what certainly you heard of. His records were hidden. This was secret material. If you had broken the Enigma, then you wouldn't necessarily run out and tell everyone, would you? In fact, they withheld information and had to get together as far as brains and strategy, war strategy, to determine which bombings they would interrupt and which ones they would allow to have happen. An ethical dilemma, most definitely. That was dramatized in the movie, was not exactly the way they portrayed it, but it was dramatized in the movie. So powerful was the machine that after the war, you know, and he certainly, they did not share that information with the American allies. In fact, Turing came to America, met with the equivalent, and wrote letters sort of disgusted about how we jumped to conclusions too readily, among other criticisms. But he was specifically sent to not share information, to share only what would sort of satisfy us so that we would not know that they had broken the code. Actually, afterward, the Enigma was given to Israel by the UK, and they were told to go ahead and use it because it was unbreakable, when all the time the UK could listen in on conversations. That piece of information sounds irrelevant to what I'm going to talk about, except it actually fuels fire about his death, which we'll discuss a little bit more. And you do wonder if they're that distrusting and manipulative, if one of the theories of his death could not be so, that he was murdered because he was a risk to national security. Speculation at this point, and we may never know. However, he went on to do many other great things besides that, but the war is, his war effort was one of perhaps the greatest ways he served mankind immediately, humanity immediately, in saving lives. Ultimately, 2 years he was credited for shortening the war. And who knows what would have happened in the interim. So pretty amazing man, right? Pretty amazing man, so smart, struggled. And in his studies, he came up with a test called the Turing test. And he modeled it a little bit after an imitation game. This is rumor, okay? This is rumor. It is a link, and it is rumor. And in the paper, supposedly it does mention there is an imitation game, or mentions the imitation game. Irrelevant at this point. This is how we get to him. And in the imitation game, as I understand in the research, it was a parlor game. Now, you know what I mean about parlor games. We don't have parlors necessarily these days. And it's even rare we all get together and play the same game. We sit perhaps and looking on a computer and we're playing games together, but they're not the same game. And we might not even be playing with each other. We may be playing with someone who's in another country or certainly another state, as our mother is playing Word Match or whatever, Trivia Crack or whatever, while someone else is, playing whatever. Thank you, Alan Turing. We can lay that one at your feet too, perhaps, at least part of it. Anyway, in the game, it involved really a core of three people. It involved a man pretending to be a woman or a woman pretending to be a man. And the point was to cleverly fool others into believing you're someone else. That was the whole point. And there was a moderator. So they would ask questions to people who were not necessarily being who they thought they were, or who they are. So if I ask Frank, and I can't see him, Frank, tell me, sort of, and remember the era, the 50s. Frank, tell me, what you should do when you're changing a baby's diaper, making the assumption that a woman would know immediately about children and all that sort of stuff. And Frank, hopefully, knew enough to fool somebody and would give an answer. Now, the woman was supposed to play as a woman, you were supposed to give your answer. And then the moderator, or the third person, was supposed to be able to kind of tell, which answer was really female answer, which was male. It's almost a test for maleness and femaleness. And, of course, we know all the problems with that. But it was imitating. It was an attempt to see if we could distinguish and figure out which was real and which wasn't. The Turing test goes on, and in a test of a machine's ability to exhibit intelligent behavior, and this is a quote from the paper, intelligent behavior equivalent to or indistinguishable from that of a human. So it's testing intelligence, which he later understood, and we understood that intelligence is really difficult to nail down. But the test, as misunderstood, is not used to really identify or define intelligence. It's used to set boundaries. So we have assumptions about femaleness. We have assumptions about intelligence. And Turing's point really was, if someone can sort of exhibit those signs of intelligence, and let's say the machine beats you, you know, the computer or the machine beats you, and or the person is fooled and says the machine is human. That was the human. And you go, oops, no. Well, do you believe that human is intelligent? Well, yes. Then the machine is intelligent too, was the point of what he was saying. The Turing test has been misused evidently quite a bit. You know, usually when media and mass everything gets hold of it, it's usually going to be misused, and it has. But it's now used in social sciences, where they are trying to explore how much we know about someone else. For instance, if I am blind and you are not, it's not so much how much do I know about sight, but how much do you as a sighted person know about blindness? And using the test to distinguish the differences in there. I don't even pretend to understand all of that sort of stuff, but what I want to get at the core today was that Alan Turing, as much of a remarkable man he was a man, was a human being. And he saw the world differently. As his mother, whom he was very close to, once said, he's quite the odd duck. Okay? And I love that. That's so true. Turing, while he was in school, was befriended and fell in love, was besotted by. Fell in love is my language, but it's one that's used elsewhere. With Christopher Morcom, who's a teenager who he was, as I said, besotted by, and that is a quote. He met in school. Morcom was kind to him. He was a year older, though Turing was taller, looked taller, because Morcom had tuberculosis, bovine tuberculosis. He befriended, as I said, he befriended Turing, and they shared a love of mathematics and logic. They shared interest in coding some, but primarily mathematics and just the interest in each other. Alan Turing wrote that he did not believe that Christopher Morcom returned his affection sort of in the same way, and said he didn't like it when he showed his affection. But he befriended him and loved him in his own way. After his death, and his friend did die, Turing was crushed. He was crushed. And unlike in the movie, those of you who've seen it, the school was very concerned. And Turing was treated more gently than the film showed, as far as acknowledging and the care he got after the death. He stayed in touch with Christopher's family. They even went on vacations together. They took him on vacation. He especially stayed in touch with Christopher's mother. Christopher had a profound effect, and his death had a profound effect on Alan. First of all, he found someone who accepted him. Not only accepted him, but loved him for whom he was. For who he was, Alan Turing, the one they would bully so much as to put under the boards. After his death, he was troubled and curious and motivated by wondering what happens to the spirit when it leaves the body. Now, understand the context again that they're operating in. You know, that's a big question. It's one that's asked today, and neurologically they didn't have all the information they had then, but still. He wrote, "Personally, I think that the spirit is really eternally connected with matter, but certainly by some, but certainly not by this, by, excuse me, was connected with matter, but certainly not by the same kind of body. So a transcendence of spirit outside." He wrote this in a paper called The Nature of Spirit and shared it with Christopher's mother. You can see that at the archives of Alan Turing. And as I alluded to at the beginning, thank goodness you can go online and actually read his handwriting in the paper. Isn't that wonderful? I thank him again for that. It's really kind of neat. He struggled after that very much with finding his place in companionship. He asked, proposed to a colleague of his, Joan Clark. I believe that is correct. Yes, Joan Clark. And asked her to marry him. He met Joan at Beckley Park and asked her to marry him. And she said yes. She also part of the Codebreakers, which her story is remarkable in itself. And her struggle to be a woman and to be recognized as a great thinker and mathematician. But he asked her to marry him. They had a lot in common, but kind of felt like they were outsiders. She said yes. He happened to tell her he was homosexual. And in an interview with her, before she passed away, before she died, she said, "Yes, he told me he was homosexual, and, you know, I know that's somewhat of a permanent condition." I love that, you know, the British sensibility. And she said, "I said, okay, we'll carry on." So it was not going to deter her, because in her explanation, she had no intention of being the perfect wife. And in that way, the movie is very true. She did not expect him to be the perfect husband, nor would she be the perfect wife. And it was actually Alan that broke it off for reasons he... you know, personal reasons of his own, whether he didn't want to live like that or whether, whatever, it was too complicated for him. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But he broke it off. And at one point, later on, she tried to even re-interest him in the proposal. And he didn't take it any further. They remained friends, though she did not see him before his death, as shown in the film. Now, I've mentioned he was gay. I don't suppose that should matter, except it did. And unfortunately, today it still does. And this is where the love comes in. This man who had given so much to his country, who had given so much to our future, the fact we even have a future and we're not, you know, perhaps saluting or going through other sorts of things that we would have under a German rule, was found guilty of gross indecency, which was a term used to describe homosexual acts between men in Britain at the time. He was found guilty of gross indecency and sentenced to prison, or he had the choice of chemical castration. That was it. It did not matter. This is after the war. Now, in the movie, it depicts that there is a sort of a bumbling detective that accidentally stumbles upon this. That is the actual character that is fictionally untrue. It was not. Alan Turing was caught up in a wave in the 1950s of purging homosexuals in the, certainly the British community, in the British society. And so he had a lover, who had a friend who he had also been intimate with, and this friend broke into his home. Now, his home was much different than yours or mine. Mine's messy. Maybe it wasn't so much burning. I don't know. But I didn't keep all sorts of dangerous chemicals around. And he had lots of things in there. It was quite messy. But he called the police because this is upsetting. And he knew someone had broken into his home. And it turned out to be his lover's friend. And Tareen confessed to the affair, knowing that, you know, knowing at one level, but he was loved, you know, he's protected. Look what he'd done. And Tareen was not, I mean, he told Joan he was a homosexual. Those are his words. He was not, it wasn't like he was trying to hide it. And lots of people have written lots of things about his, why he did that. One, I think, that most speaks to him is he had an air of naivete about, you know, people who could not understand what he understood. The danger's not in the smart sometimes. The danger's in the ignorant. And so he chose chemical castration. And for 2 years, or I think it's a year and a half, underwent chemical castration, taking harmful chemicals to his body. At one point, you know, it can cause you to grow breasts and things like that because it's just harmful. Anyway, 14 months, and this is not what the movie, not only, but a lot of things condensed time. He lived 14 months after the castration, the medication ended. So he lived after that and was still working. But in 1954, shortly before his 42nd birthday, he died. By suicide, the report was. Suicide, they assumed, because of a laced apple. And that is his cause of death, officially. Now, I said there were three. No doubt he was distraught. No doubt he was disturbed by what had taken place. Certainly, I've given you the situation where he might have been forced, you know, a death that was not one of his choice, because at that time to be a homosexual meant to be a security risk, period. Second was, you know, that he did commit suicide. He had a habit of gold plating, not a habit, a hobby, of gold plating things, and he experimented with gold plating spoons. And it was one of the few things. And so that took cyanide in different form, just cyanide was involved in it. And he certainly had the chemicals there at his disposal to put on the apple to then eat it. He had a habit. His supposed favorite movie was Snow White. And he had a habit of eating apples before he went to bed. Now, his mother, whom he loved and knew, you know, was her odd duck, did not believe it was suicide. Nor did she believe it was foul play. She went and found a spoon similar to one he had gold-plated and believed very much that he was in the process of gold-plating another spoon, and as she said carelessly, did not wash his hands before he went to bed. Does that not sound like your mother? Wash your hands. Now see what happens. You'll die of cyanide poisoning. With, I guess if you had a son as brilliant as Alan Turing and into everything, that might be true. She said he was very sloppy in things and he had a very sloppy house, and that's what she believed more than anything. Who knows? That's not the point. The point is that instead of loving someone, instead of accepting someone, the society wrung out all it could from this man because he did not fit, because he did not go back to this imitation game of being an either or and sticking with a male or female. Then he was bullied. He was headed for imprisonment. He was forced to chemically alter his body. At that time of purging, 49,000 men were found guilty of indecency. There are some 15,000 still alive. In 2009, Turing was given an official apology. It took to 2013 before the Queen granted a pardon for Turing. The other 49,998 They're not pardoned for expressing their sexuality, for being who they are to some degree. In 2003, 30,000 gay and bisexual men were convicted. So in 2003, still happening. There is actually a petition being started by people who are concerned about this, and the actor that portrayed Turing in the movie, Cumberbatch, has signed it, and it is to request the pardon of these men, not just to, which is important. So Turing, motivated by love, seeking to figure out where his friend went, as we all do that have lost people. "Where are you, Dad?" I asked last February when his body stopped. "Where did you go? Did you just cease?" Alan was 20 when he wrote that about the spirit. This was not a young child's longing for his friend, in as much as it was a scientific effort to try to figure out that sense in love. In his memory, I would request that we today do what we can to make sure that we're standing on the right side of love, that we are encouraging those who are not as brilliant as Turing to make sure that they are cared for, protected, and to know that they have an advocate and someone who loves them as they are. And that is something that we can do, not only for Turing, but for others throughout our history and for those to come, as a way of giving back for their spirits, for their love that they bring, and for the goodness they continue to offer through their work and quirkiness. Thank you for your time and your effort today to listen through this rather long one. But thank you again.